Hi, folks. Thank you so much for joining me for, well, a bonus episode this week, actually, of Soundtrack. And that's because there are so many films flying around at the minute that we wanted to try and cover as many as we can. Normally, we drop an episode every Monday, but we're throwing an extra one in today to tie in with the release of Fall Guy. In fact, there's two films out today, Fall Guy and Love Lies Bleeding. Both deserve your attention in the cinema. And we will be hearing from Love Lies Bleeding co-writer and director Rose Glass on Monday. But today it is all about Fall Guy. But first, before we get to that, I wanted to say thank you very much to Sid for their lovely email that they sent in about the show. If you want to get in touch with the show, for whatever reason that may be, Sid has got a suggestion for an episode, which I'll get to in a second. But you might want to talk about, well, whatever really, around film, music and TV. To do that, just drop us an email, info@edithbowman.com. And yeah, and I'll get back to you as and when I can. But this is from Sid, who says, "Hi Edith, hope you're well. I'm good, thanks. I'm not going to lie, I'm a little bit croaky today. I watched my husband's band Editors play at Brixton Academy last night, which was phenomenal. First big proper gig back since the venue reopened. And just wanted to say a massive thanks to all the staff there for just helping it run like clockwork. It was brilliant. And to everybody who came, it was a beautiful night. So there we go. Hence why I'm croaky today. But back to Sid's email. I wanted to share that I absolutely adore Soundtrack and it's one of my favourite podcasts. Sid, thank you. Your interviews are always well researched and thoughtful and your genuine love for film is infectious. It is genuine and I feel very lucky that I get to do this podcast. The podcast has helped me through grad school, hospitalizations and long periods on my own, so I wanted to say thank you." Oh, Sid, thank you. That's the kindest and loveliest thing that you can say, because that's all we want to feel to people, is a bit like a friend and a companion. "Also a small wish, though I know how difficult this would be. As a huge Marvel fan, I've always dreamt of listening to the composers from the different Marvel movies having a chat, comparing experiences, discussing what it's like to continue a theme that someone else has developed, etc. I think you would be the person to moderate this, so I wanted to mention it. Thanks again and all the best." Sid, this is a great idea, and I love that idea of bringing together different voices from those worlds, whether it's Pinar Toprak and Alan Silvestri. There's a whole host of them that we could bring together as well. Michael Giacchino. So, Sid, let me get onto this and send out some emails and see if we can maybe make something work around an anniversary. One thing as well, Sid, that I'm always trying to do is trying to get Kevin Feige on, because Kevin Feige runs the whole machine and has been involved so much in the music across all the films since they started. So let me get onto that as well. And there's a nice Marvel connection with our episode today with Fall Guy, because the writer of Fall Guy, Drew Pearce, my very lovely old dear friend, wrote Iron Man 2. So there you go. Anyway, so a Fall Guy special for you today, as director David Leitch, producer Kelly McCormick and writer Drew Pearce join me to discuss their brilliant film. The film stars Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, and it tells the story of a stuntman working on his ex-girlfriend's directorial debut who gets ensnared into a conspiracy surrounding the film's lead actor. Some of you might remember the 80s TV show that the film is kind of inspired by. Same character name, same job, same title, but that's kind of where the similarities end, really. This is a brilliantly modern, funny take on that character and the world of movies and really the stunt world, the under-celebrated world of the stunt world. It is very, very funny. And a lot of that is down to Gosling and Blunt, who together have this wonderfully charismatic, natural comedy. The supporting cast add bundles of energy and joy, and I absolutely loved it for so many reasons. It really reminded me of growing up and going to the cinema and seeing those kind of romantic comedies, like action comedies, like Romance in the Stone. It is that brilliant marriage of comedy, romance and action. And which, let's face it, on a big screen can be pretty perfect. So let's get to our guests. First up, David and Kelly, who, not for the first time, enlisted the services of Dominic Lewis to compose. And we'll begin with his cue, Post-it Party. We'll be right back. to see you guys again. The last thing we said when we were chatting about Bullet Train was like, so we got Fog Eye to look forward to, and here we are.
I know. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
I feel like coming out of the cinema from watching your film, it's kind of like what I felt like as a kid and what kind of sparked loving going to the cinema. Your film has all of those things in it. You know, it's kind of got that action, it's got that romance, it's got that music. So huge congratulations.
Thank you.
Genuinely loved it. I mean, there's so much to talk about because we'll get on to music in a second, but this whole idea where it just feels like a real love letter to filmmaking as well. Is that fair?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think we really wanted to celebrate the sort of the artisans that make these movies and just how much love they have for cinema. And then also celebrate big popcorn movies and like make one that is worthy for you to go and put your money down and have a good time and escape for 2 hours. We want those to come back, and they need to come back.
It's also this really clever and brilliant thing that you've done where we feel like we're almost kind of watching behind the scenes of a movie, but it's a movie. It's this kind of really, you've created almost like a new universe that sits between the two almost in a way. Was that deliberate, Kelly?
It was. Yeah. Thank you for noticing. I mean, you know, honestly, a set is sort of stranger than normal life, if that's possible. And it was, and we have so much experience on all of our sets to like, as fodder to like give to this kind of movie. So it, we got a little hyper excited about it. And I think you can tell because we're just adding more and more and more. But you know, David does so well in his films is kind of create a sort of realistic, but new world, if that makes sense. Like it is a touch like normal life or a normal set, but it's just a little heightened.
Yeah.
This gave him the opportunity to do that on a set of a movie.
And was that in itself a journey, you know, in terms of the initial idea to almost kind of listening to what your ideas were and what you wanted it to be to what you ended up shooting, you know, in terms of well, that first kind of going, let's do Fall Guy to what you ended up, you know, making the film about. Was that a big journey in itself?
It was, it was a big journey, you know, early on, you know, I think the story started out with a little bit more of like investigation forward and a little bit more like a noir story of a guy, of an underdog hero. And all that element is in there. But as it started to become more of a celebration of like movie making, it was hard to not bring all these joyful elements. And I think, look, we built up Jody's character early on after a first draft where, you know, Kelly had a great idea to convert her from a makeup artist to a director. And that was sort of the first time director with all the stakes and, you know, her, she was sort of an equal. And then I think having Emily and Ryan in the mix, like the love story, which was just a thread at the beginning, started to evolve in a really big way to become like the spine of the movie.
Yeah. That choice was also my little like plug toward let's give women more opportunities behind the camera as a director. Mm-hmm. But we figured that if she had the weight of this biggest dream that she's ever had of her career on her shoulders, when this person she really would be rocked by arrives, that it made the stakes so high for her. And that gave us a place for Emily to play and to, you know, create the amazing Jody that she did with all the layers and nuance of like, she's upset enough to set him on fire a few times, but she's also so warm and so ready and vulnerable to hope that maybe there's a chance for them again. While she's juggling like Metal Storm, the coolest, like, you know, action, love, epic sci-fi adventure that's ever been made, you know?
And those two are magical on screen together and the kind of the way they riff off each other, and you know, it feels, that's again what feels like you're almost kind of fly on the wall a lot of the time in terms of the conversations just feel so real. Did you give them kind of a lot of freedom to kind of play with those conversations and, you know, the reactions and things? Was that important?
Yeah, I mean, they're both listening actors, and that's a real gift to be able to be more free.
Yeah.
You know, we kind of knew the we were all making the same movie, first of all, which is great. And then you know the pillars of production with regards to like what set pieces you need, but then also where the characters need to pivot to like have the highs and lows and really arc both of them. And then within that, David gives this safe ground where you can just play, and they both like to do that, and they both listen to each each other and want each other to have the best moment or take the best moment or really be able to meld into that. I think it's what makes it feel really so messy and modern and real and connectable. To me, it's like that. Emily kept saying, and I thought it rang true to me, that it felt like the biggest independent film that she's ever been on because there was this freedom to it. It didn't feel like it was completely like set. And that was kind of a compliment actually in the filmmaking process. Yeah.
Totally.
It's all those moments where they're kind of, they both want the last word. And it's kind of a comment that they make that they kind of maybe don't want the other person to hear, but they do. Yeah, that kind of really fine line. Yes. It's so great. It just makes you invest in them as individuals, but as that relationship as well. It's so great to watch.
Thank you.
But let's talk music, because music is a big part of this film in so many ways as well. And, you know, we start and we arrive with I Was Made for Loving You.
Yeah.
And that kind of really... Well, it's such a big part of the film because it, you know, and I'm sure I've only seen the film once, but I'm sure in the sort of second and third viewing, I'll find even more there. But it is weaved,
as the within song, the score,
but then within the score. So
do you remember another movie that did that? You being the cinephile, like audio.
So there is, and I was trying to think about it this morning because I've spoken to someone not too long ago about it, and I just can't because all I've got in my head is I Was Made for Loving You. And I can't kind of erase it at the minute. I'm too in this film, but
it is pretty unique. It's pretty rare.
Absolutely. To do what you've done with it specifically and kind of,
deconstructed it. And we actually use it as Colt's theme. And that was sort of like, you know, get the license. We wanted to get the license of the song to the point where we could use it and deconstruct it. And then we orchestrated it. We shot a lot of pieces of the orchestrated version here at Abbey Road in London. And then we did a cover version, a ballad version with Youngblood.
Yeah.
Tonight, I want to give it all to you. In the darkness, there's so much I want to do. And tonight, I wanna lay it at your feet. Cause girl, I was made for you. And girl, you were made for me.
So you bring it back full circle and use it at the end to sort of as your anthem. The idea with Kiss for me was always tonally, they are equal parts camp and cool. And I think that the fun and cool factor, the camp and cool factor of Colt, you know, he is sort of this guy who's fish out of water and he's a little bumbling at times, but he's also like cool as shit. And like, there's something that really sets the tone for the movie. Number one, you hear that guitar lick. You want to have a good time. You're setting up the expectation of fun. But again, like, you have camp and cool throughout the film, and it works.
Funny story. David had it written into the script.
Yeah.
And Kiss was going to actually be their band. Like, we had all these Kiss t-shirts. David on the junket. He was often wearing a Kiss t-shirt.
Yeah.
And we had made a bunch of them, and it was going to be their band. And, like, the truck scene was about Kiss and them loving their band. And all of us didn't get it, quite honestly. I think Ryan was closest to maybe
Ryan was
receiving it. And Emily and I were like, what's that? And like, the studio was like, really, Kiss? Like, and we shot it without any of that in the movie because we all weren't there. Then we get back, editorial happens. There's three movies happening in the movie, right? There's like the set, there's like the movie within the movie, and then there's like the investigation on the side. Yeah. And it felt disjointed with anything other than Kiss within the soundscape. It was so important to David and so part of the DNA of what he built this movie around that no other song worked.
Tonight, I wanna give it all to you.
And now we're like, oh my God, of course, Kiss. Like, that was the perfect idea. It's so brilliant. And he was manipulating us the whole time. He knew it's what you need until it's gone.
I'm fine for all ideas to be challenged. I was collaborating.
You were collaborating.
What were the conversations that you had with Dominic, though, in terms of kind of, you know, because it's it's another journey for a composer to kind of have the framework to something, but also to create their own around it and within it and on top of it.
Yeah, I think he got really excited about the idea too, because it's a fresh idea. Yeah. Or it hadn't been done in a long time. And he's like, yeah, let's
do
it.
And he is all things camp and cool. I mean, Dominic Lewis is like camp and cool. Like, if you look it up, that's who's there.
That's what we need on a t-shirt.
Camp and cool. Yeah. He was really excited about the experiment and started building suites with it. And then, you know, what's crazy is that we also had Colton Jody's theme, which was a romance theme that had a lot of the same chord structures and things that he had designed separately before. Yeah. I told him about this one.
Oh, wow.
And then you'll hear it in the Youngblood track, the orchestration. It's the two themes coming together. It's sort of I Was Made for Loving You and then Jody and Colt's theme. When we had the orchestra at Abbey Road play that, like, we were all just like goosebumps and... But again, that's his musical genius, like fine-tuning it and making it all come together. And so that those two things worked seamlessly.
Journey as well for you with in terms of the narrative of how you navigate the music that is placed in other parts of the film as well, you know, in terms of what do you want to have, like, you know, diegetic, or what do you want to have come in as score, and then you've got the karaoke scene.
Yeah.
You know, all that kind of stuff. There are the music in itself is a character that goes on different journeys as well.
Yeah, it's the stuff that we like to do in the movie. I mean, I like to use the music as a storytelling tool.
Yeah.
And an experience tool. I love needle drops so much that I try to find the fresh ways to use them and the fun ways to use them and the audience is going to enjoy the most. You know, the Taylor Swift cue is the one that is now, I just want to move on to that because
we had choice was that?
Well, that was Kelly's choice. And yes. we had tried so many love cues there. And at one point it was NXS and at one point it was Harry Nilsson. Without You, which is a beautiful song. But none of them really landed like this Taylor cue.
Well, I think part of it's because it's a modern love story. They're so messy and it's so fluid and they're allowed to be. And I think that's what we allow more than maybe ever before, certainly in cinema. And so all those cues felt a little too sort of not modern enough, you know? And it's actually hard to lay Taylor into a movie because she is a storyteller, one of the most brilliant working today. And she's got so much detail in her story that then adding like picture to it is a little too much a lot of the time. Him sitting having this moment about heartbreak to the heartbreak anthem from a woman's perspective. With all the imagery that's happening is doing way more than any other song could have and did.
Yeah.
And then it's really funny actually when it's interrupted and he, because everybody cries to Taylor Swift.
but it's that reversal that you have in the kind of preconception of what that would be. You know, it'd be hard listening to it. That's right. What you right. You know, yes. And, yeah. And having a cry. And the fact that you flipped that and it's Ryan and she's kind of going, you cry? It's just, it makes it even funnier and more brilliant. Yeah. And, yeah and
we got a, in a test screening, a focus group spoke about that song in specific and she was a Swiftie fan and she's like, you do not understand how perfect of a placement that is. It's both so emotional and so funny and we Swifties understand. And it was like the biggest compliment we got outside of Steven Spielberg, I think. And it was
I heard you've seen it. I loved it.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was amazing.
That's a stamp, isn't it?
That's a big stamp.
That's amazing.
It was insane. Yeah. Oh, your sweet disposition and my wide-eyed gaze. We're singing in the car, getting lost up state. Autumn leaves falling down like pieces into place. And I can picture it after all these days. And I know it's long gone and that magic's not. Personal choices that you placed in here, or talk to me a little bit about that.
Oh, well, I mean, songs that I love. Yeah. I mean, you know,
the Against All. Everybody's done Genie in a Bottle.
Yeah. Genie in a Bottle. Yes. Right. Right. I personally like Wanted Dead or Alive. That's my go-to song. That did not make it, but they did use Bon Jovi for some of the materials. So, you know, maybe it's sort of
it
still
was in
the
there.
DNA.
See, you're just manipulating everybody.
And
they
know. They just knew it. They knew it. Look, the Phil Collins track was something that, again, it's like I wanted to pull at the emotional heartstrings.
Yeah.
And so you have a needle drop that's really perfect for, obviously, forlorn. And the other thing that's great about the Phil Collins thing is it leads into this epic score. And, you know, it's got orchestra at the end and it's super melodramatic. And it was exactly kind of what we needed for that spot. And
we tried a bunch of other things. We made them sing A, B, C, D, E, F, U, if you remember that song.
I love that you made them film them. This is brilliant.
This is
going to be on like the DVD extras where we get all these
If we could get the license, maybe.
They're a little expensive. So right now they might not be there. But
we had Alanis Morissette.
And it was a duet with Gail showing up for half of it, like to, you know, You Ought to Know.
To like downgrade that singing voice. I mean, Emily's well, really.
No,
do you know what
both,
I mean? They're both like.
She's Mary Poppins.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like they're the real deal.
Together, are amazing. It's like angels.
Power.
Wow. Yeah. That's great. Hannah's
did record Winston's.
Yeah, Winston was singing. He was Can You Talk by Tevin Campbell. So that was just another scene that didn't make the movie. But
didn't make the movie, but it was awesome.
It was a fun day.
So
everyone
good.
Was singing karaoke. It was a fun day.
The best day. Except Emily like lost her voice by the end because she made her sing so many different things.
We had a lot of songs that we were playing with.
But the Phil Collins was the one that was in the script that was sort of planned. And then we wanted to just in case...
Yeah.
Because it was broken up. So do we watch her sing all these things and she's like having this emotional meltdown all the way through?
Yeah.
It didn't quite work. We needed to keep her really, you know, in the emotion of the Phil Collins.
Yeah.
And it just played so well with the choreography of the stunts that we ended up sticking with that song. So take a look at me now. There's just an empty space. There's nothing.
I loved and I properly laughed out loud was when I heard, or I kind of fist pumped the air, was when the Miami Vice theme comes in for just that smile. And I was like, hands are tied behind me. Yes! It's just all these little moments that are just, it's so clever. It's so,
Thank you.
Brilliant. What's the kind of process of thinking about weaving all that in there? Because there's also all these other brilliant movie, you know, mentions and stuff, you know, whether it's Pretty Woman or Notting Hill and Love Actually and Thelma Louise and all that stuff.
You know, you can't have it all on the page before you go. You can, I mean, it's, but we don't, you know, it's like we have a great script. Obviously, Drew is an amazing writer. You know, what's fun working with Drew as, like, as a collaborator, he knows we're going to go crazy on in production. And you do make the movie three times. You write a script, then you make the movie, and then you make it in post.
Yeah.
And so while we're making the movie, that's a really, really formidable time. And we allow for that magic to happen. The Miami Vice thing is, again, sort of a costume idea. Like, Ryan found this vintage jacket with Mark Avery, his costumer. Amazing. It has Miami Vice stunt show, Universal live show on the back. And we're like, oh, my God. Okay. A lot of stunt performers start out in live shows. Let's build something around this. And then I call the stunt team. We start to design the sequence more about boats. So that's sort of changing in the script. You know, we're 6 weeks out from production during that time. So it's like time's careening, but you got to go with it because it's so fun and you know you're going to have a plant payoff. It was always in my head, like, the minute he hits the throttle, we're going to hit the Miami Vice cue.
From him, and then I'm trying to keep an eye out, but he mostly is like keeping track of the little things that he's planting and the smallest things to the biggest things and how he's going to pay him off in the end. And it's just always really exciting to see how they come together.
Yeah, sometimes it's just a prop that shows up on set and then somebody's inspired by it and you make a comment on it. And
it's great.
Yeah.
I loved as well that Miami Vice jacket. It was also a little nod to Drive, I felt, in a way as well.
Oh, interesting. Because it was quite
similar to his jacket in Drive.
Likes,
so I kind of like that. Because obviously for that, he... You know, he talks about how he learned so much from the stunt team from kind of preparing for that role as well. So it's a nice kind of through line
there
as well.
Nice.
Sure.
Yeah. I love how you give us a real insight, though, into kind of what it's like to be in that position. Not in kind of huge depth of it, but you get a real sense of what it's like when, you know, that first scene where he's in the car and you kind of, you're hearing all the radios go off and what's happening. He's got to hit that. And then that, you know, in terms of, it's just, it's really celebratory for us as film fans to get to see the work that goes into stuff like that as well. Was that always something you really wanted to incorporate into this, to kind of really pay homage? You know, and it's part of your background as well.
I mean, obviously 20 years in the business or 20 plus years as a stunt performer coordinator, it was really important to me. But that scene in particular, right, you know, it was really, I wanted to create an experiential moment and like to put you in the, you know, position of like the things he's hearing. And like, so the music comes out for a second and now it's just these little pieces of sound design that you're kind of going into tunnel vision of like trying to think of all the things you need to do and like waiting for that cue, action, action, action. It's a pretty good representation, I have to say. When I see it, it's like that's how you feel. You feel you're really focusing in on the radio chatter because, you know, you're making sure everything is in place. Because if you take off and stuff's not in place, you need to bail.
There's also so much great action in so many great action movies that it's like from this perspective, we got to tell it from a different lens. Mm-hmm. And that was really important to us from moment go. The darkness cue that sort of punctuates the opera house like extravaganza that is, to me, just showcasing some of the beauty of stunts, the parts of stunts that you never get to see.
Can't explain all the feelings that you're making me feel. In overdrive and you're behind the steering wheel. Touching you, touching me, touching you. God, you touch your mood. I believe in a big cold love. Touch
rope and the ratchet happening and the guy flying off. That actually really happens. You just usually don't see any of that stuff.
And again and again and again.
And again and again and again. Yeah. And
oh my God, he's back.
And it was this opportunity we had to show this really personal character-based action, but from this like totally different gaze with all of the stuff behind the scenes in the, you know, informing what's going on. That was super important to us from moment go of taking the title on.
Post-it notes. Oh my God. I mean, literally, I'm like,
post-it notes.
I was like squinting, you know, trying to read as many as you can. It's kind of like,
oh my God, they're
kind
so
of challenging.
Funny,
like, okay, how many can I read on this show? It's like, oh, okay. Is it mimosa? You know, it's that, all that kind of stuff. It's like, that's a lot of fun. And that's again, it's like, I feel like the film's kind of got this afterlife almost in a way where there are so many Easter eggs in there. There are so many things that you can kind of dive into, you know, and kind of like freeze frame it and kind of check in on things and all that kind of stuff. It's like, it's just kind of like a treasure trove.
David's a maximalist. And more is more, you know, and like you're gonna get more, and watching it more and more and more, you just enjoy it even more.
It's like, there's a lot of fun things on those. So we had the art department had the best time. Like,
oh my God.
Everyone was like taking notepads. We had notepads all over, writing them and putting them all over because we needed, oh, we got to dress this corner now. You know, you got 10 minutes.
And instead like, of like putting the ones there that were already, they wanted to make more and they had so many more jokes
so
and it was so fun for them.
It's so crazy. And in terms of all those film references as well, you know, in terms of what films you referenced and why,
that was sort of, you know, on the day or even within, not just even on the day, but within different moments. Like, but David smartly, I think, placed those into for two reasons. One is to give it super close connectability with Winston Duke's character and Ryan Gosling's character, and that they had this bond about cinema.
History.
And it felt so familial automatically when you're meeting them and then they're just going to, you know, to the quote. And then the other reason that he, you know, sort of demanded that we infuse it and think of really fun ones that would connect them is because, you know, people who we wanted to celebrate that people who make film love film. And that was such a great way to prove that Winston was a cinephile. And obviously, you know, Colt is too. Yeah. And that they have these super connective sort of, you know, phrases that they use all the time. And I think it was just a really shortcut, awesome way of, you know, expressing that.
Two quick things before we finish. Is it the $6 million man sound effects that you hear at one point?
Yes.
I was like, it's like, it's one of those things that kind of like, but it's those things that kind of just, it's almost like a part of your life flashes in front of you through the connection to a sound or a song.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. It was like, oh my God, I haven't heard that in eight. It felt so warm and comfortable hearing it.
Yeah. I just wanted to make you smile.
Yeah. And then you said that if people like it, there may well be more Fall Guy. I loved it. Please tell me there's going to be more.
Oh.
Can you make a call? Let's go.
I think you guys are in a better position than I am. I really hope there is.
We do too.
We would love to do more.
There's a lot more adventures they could go on.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
So many.
So many more tunes to play as well.
Yeah. So much more music to play.
David Kelly, thank you so much for your time. It's always a treat to get to chat to you.
Thank you.
And even more so to watch your films as well. So thank you.
From the score to the Fall Guy, that's Bon Garçon by Dominic Lewis, rounding off this first part of soundtracking with David Leitch and Kelly McCormick. Next up is my dear old friend Drew Pearce. I'm just going to add, it's so funny interviewing friends. It's really odd. Drew wrote the screenplay and we'll lead into him with another of Dominic's cues, Metal Storm. We'll be right back.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
You made me laugh a lot. And having known you for a few years, there are so many Drewisms that just jump on and make me smile just thinking about them. But it's just you. You can feel you coming off the screen in this script. So congratulations.
Well, that's good. Maybe the most charming version of myself because it's delivered by the incredibly handsome and much funnier than me, Ryan Gosling. But I'll take it. Like, as an avatar. What a brilliant delivery system of your own stuff.
Why the Fall Guy?
Loads of reasons. First of all, the rights came free.
Yeah.
Someone gave me a call. I think they were expecting me to say, I don't want to remake an 80s TV show. But the interesting thing is, growing up, The Fall Guy was like a really massive part of my, when I was very little. You know, it was on telly on a Saturday night. Mm-hmm. I used to sit down and watch it with my dad, and it was like our favourite show. And I basically was obsessed with being a stunt person. You know me, so this won't surprise you. It's quite a Drewish approach to hyperfixation. So I created a stunt course in my backyard. Had my little digital watch. One summer I timed myself round and round and round this course, like all day, every day. I couldn't afford like knee and arm pads, but I knew that stuntmen had to have them. But what I did have was like crappy like sweatbands, so I would like put them on my knees and on my elbows. And so me and my mates used to play at being stunt people, which is demented, obviously.
This is a prequel.
Yeah, exactly. We should have shot it Shane Black style and like put them in as flashbacks. But weirdly, there was already something in my sense memory about it. And then obviously David was a part of it, and I've worked with Leach for years. Mm-hmm. And the chance to do something personal inside a big movie was really, I felt really rare. And the development was interesting because, like, Dave and Kelly weren't sure which direction to go. And so I prepped two ideas. One was like a kind of bigger, more Mission Impossible style film, like a stunt team that kind of go solve world problems. And then this other one, which was secretly more of a noir, which was kind of inspired by The Long Goodbye and California Split and all my favorite 70s shaggy dog kind of investigations.
Yeah.
And luckily we got to go with that one, partly because that felt like the best vessel for tapping into David's own life, real stunt performers.
Yeah.
And honestly, a way into a romance, which is the thing that, you know, Ryan was most excited about, which was just, you know, a gift to me.
Yeah. It's almost like three films in one, really, mm-hmm. in a way as well, because, and I love that side of it, where we feel like we're almost having a on-set tour in a way at moments. Do you know what I mean? Where we get to see the complexities of things that are involved, but also, you know, like the Jodie character is how she approaches being a director for the first time. And she, obviously there's things she wants to do, you know, when she's almost kind of checking in how she deals, all that kind of stuff as well. And I imagine from your experience and working in this world for so long of bringing so much realness and truth into that as well, you know, and that experience of what it's like to be a stunt person, what it's like to be a first time director, all these kind of things as well. So that's why I feel like it's such a joy to watch, because you're watching a really entertaining film, but you are also getting a real insight into the industry in a way as well.
Well, I like films that give insight into any world in what feels like authentic or granular detail. Yeah. It's like the reason you love Michael Mann movies is because in Thief, you really get the sense that he, as he did, hung out with real safecrackers for 2 years in order to get that reality. And in this movie, that's really important, I think, because, you know, the scale of the movie looks like one thing, but the intimacy and the authenticity, I guess, of the romance is the most important thing. If you don't buy that romance, there's no engine to the film. And in order for the romance to feel real, the kind of on-set stuff has to as well. In many ways, it's a workplace rom-com. And so you have to believe the workplace in very, you know, kind of moment-to-moment detail in order to believe the romance in moment-to-moment detail.
Yeah.
So actually, that's why those two things complement each other so much, I think, because one needs the other.
I mean, I've only seen it once, and I imagine every time I see it again, and I will watch it on repeat.
Please, but buy a ticket next time, yeah?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I will find more and see more and whatever, whether that's the Easter eggs that are in there, all those amazing film references, whether it's, you know, between Winston and Ryan's character, whether it's a kind of flippant remark about Memento, you know, all that kind of stuff. You must have had, knowing you, the fun you've had dropping all those into the script as you write it.
Well, my favourite one is actually like even more macro.
Yeah.
Don't know if you've seen Peter O'Toole's movie, The Stuntman, which is maybe,
I'm not actually,
it's maybe the best stunt movie, well, certainly my favourite okay. stunt movie. And it starts with a long one-er of a director and the actor kind of walking through a set, and then they get on a cherry picker, and yeah. the camera stays with them as it kind of rises up. And so actually the opening, which we use as the, you know, establishment of the romance, that is actually, was always in the script as like a reference to my favourite stunt movie. So yeah, there's lots of texture in there, and hopefully it goes beyond just like lines from films as
yeah.
well. Like hopefully it's, you know, it's baked in from the jump.
In different ways as well.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
the Miami Vice thing even as well, you know, about that being part of his, you know, I did that stunt so many times. Like, and then when that cue comes in, and
I mean,
it's just...
You can't beat Jan Hammer.
I mean, you can't beat Miami Vice.
You really can't. By the way, I will say, also a massive fan of the movie version of Miami Vice. Much maligned. Yeah. Director's cut, by the way, also a banger at 3 hours.
Do you think we're going to get a director's cut of The Fall Guy? Because I think, if nothing else, I just want to see all those test karaoke songs.
I've actually heard that there is the possibility of an extended version. But I don't even know if I'm allowed to say that. So,
well, you have already said
I mean,
that.
I kind of have. But yeah, I definitely couldn't give any details about what would be in there.
What about music in terms of how much is embedded in that script? Because, you know, talking about that opening scene, you know,
yeah.
there's so much... Within the script, it's not just dialogue. It's not, there are directions, there are specifics around these characters and stuff. So how much music were you kind of putting in there for those characters, for that situation, for the world?
Well, it actually changed along the way. One of the original ideas that David wanted to explore, which didn't end up totally in there, was the idea that they'd met at like a Kiss concert.
Yeah, heard about
it. I don't know if David said yeah. that. And so at one point it was just Kiss songs, which was kind of fun to write because, like, you know, you're kind of doing like a jukebox musical meets a stunt thing, which is interesting because there is literally a movie called Stunt Rock, which isn't like Australian.
Just gonna write all of these down.
Like an Australian exploitation movie that is about stuntmen but is also a rock opera. Which is something I've pitched to Leach for the sequel.
Okay.
So, I mean, watch this space, I would say. Like, it's definitely not a hard confirm by the sounds of it. But, you know, I'm going to work on it. But the movie itself, because, you know, I came into this and I said to Dave, for this one, let's play the hits. We're all people who have done, you know, movies of this scale. Let's be super ambitious with, like, the intimacy and the smallness of it. And then let's play the hits on the rest of it. And that's why the music's so important, because I do feel like the movie itself is kind of like a power ballad. It's like catchy and emotional and bombastic and cheesy purposefully when it wants to be. And, you know, and kind of leaves you with a kind of fist pump at the end. So I guess what I'm saying is it's the Meatloaf of movies. But I'm not sure that's a poster quote. But
I think that's a genius poster quote.
Maybe.
He's not going to come and see that.
Yeah, I mean, well, exactly.
that's amazing.
Cut to Universal shouting at me for destroying 10 weeks of amazing marketing.
Oh, my God, I love that.
Because this is for soundtracking, though, I realised something this weekend. I finally saw Godzilla X Kong.
Yeah.
And it shares a huge music cue with our film, which I didn't realize. I Was Made for Loving You is in both movies.
Yeah.
And like really featured in both.
You didn't know that?
I didn't know that yeah. Kong was going to have it as well.
Yeah.
And I was sitting in the cinema, I was like, ooh, no, I should have fact checked this. but weirdly, no one seems to have picked up on it yet.
My 15-year-old did.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, totally. And it's that kind of thing where it's, when I came back the other day, and he hasn't even seen it.
Right.
I came back the other day and I was like, because we've seen the trailer so many times. Every time we go to the movie, it's there, and they're so excited to see it. And I was like, oh, I saw it today. He's like, is it good? I was like, it's fantastic. You'll love it. Got, and he's like, what's the music like? And I said, and he was like, oh, they used that in Kong. And I was like, God, yeah, they did. Well done. You're like...
I also think it's a cultural thing. I don't think as British people, we realise the pop cultural footprint that Kiss had in the States compared with here. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't grow up like hearing Kiss on like classics radio. Do you know what I mean? Not
no,
really.
They're a little bit like a novelty band, weirdly.
Yeah. And
in
the States,
well,
that's not how they are. They're like Aerosmith, or they're seen as like a classic rock band.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why it's so surprising that that track is in like two movies in the same summer.
But what's clever in The Fall Guy is the way that it's weaved throughout the entire...
It's incredible.
It's so clever.
Yeah, Dave and Dom did such a brilliant job of the kind of like insane, like prog, like power ballad version that kind of, I think it's like 7 minutes long, that's just so good.
Yeah, and kind of getting Youngblood in to do a kind of ballad version of it.
That's
and
right.
And then just all that kind of stuff. It's just, it's really, really clever as well. Karaoke songs.
Of course.
Every good film should have them. Phil Collins.
I'm not sure that's actually true,
no,
but go on. Right,
yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking of a couple of really
bad
ones.
Dune 2
actually
would have been really weird with the karaoke
scene. It would have
scene.
Been. Talking
but
of which,
I would have enjoyed it.
Talking of which, that's another thing that I love in terms of like the movie that's being made in this film. You know, there's a little kind of nudge, or a completely blatant nudge to Dune. even in the score moment that kind of doesn't quite do the but it's there.
I kind of feel, Edith, like what you're saying about this is that Dune 2 needed more cowboy hats and space cowboys.
Gold. Needed more gold.
Yeah, lame costumes. It was the one ingredient Denis forgot for Dune 2. It would have really taken it over the air. Imagine if Timmy was on the back of that big worm
doing karaoke,
but there was a cowboy hat on as well. I mean, it's thematically correct.
I think Colt being the stunt guy on Dune 3 is
maybe it'll happen.
Maybe it'll be happening.
Yeah, it feels like the Dune series really fits tonally with what we're doing on The Fall Guy, so I'm excited for the crossover.
In terms of the writing, as the characters are kind of progressing, and when you first come on board, do you know if someone's attached to this? When you're creating those two versions that you talked about, do you know who ideally is going to be in those kind of lead roles and stuff? Because the way they play these characters, Emily and Ryan and stuff, it's so natural. Those conversations feel so real. You feel like you're eavesdropping on someone having a genuine conversation. That's great script writing. It's great performance. Are you writing for them specifically?
Every movie's different. Sometimes the cast come on right at the last minute. We put the pitch together for this, and Ryan actually came in from the pitch onwards, which is insanely useful because it means every draft I wrote, first of all, had Ryan's feedback, and then ultimately had dialogue he was feeding in, and then Emily came on board, and Emily's just like, she's the best. And super funny. One thing I learned on Iron Man was it's to your advantage to check your ego and let an actor who is naturally more funny than you'll ever be take the reins, because it makes you look better because they are brilliant. And like, again, I feel like in this, I gave everyone the groundwork, but they brought such a naturalness and an authenticity to their scenes. That's why they're my favorite scenes.
What was the most important bit of feedback you got from both of them then? Do you think that helped you in terms of...
One thing we learned as the script went along, and one of the trickiest things, was engineering ways to get them on screen together throughout the movie. Because technically, he shouldn't see her for the whole of the second act until the third act, right? Mm-hmm. Because he's off doing investigations. So, you know, there's lots of tricks to try and kind of like force them together and then make you think they're going to come together and then they don't. You know, that's the catch and release of the rom-com in general. So that was a big thing I learned. The reason I learned it was because I was watching great pairings on screen, like two stars in a movie, because actually often in rom-coms, there's like a dominant person and then someone that's not as well known. But if you really start to dig into the genre, obviously there are kind of two-handers. And I want it to feel like a two-hander, even though the plot is driven by Colt, by Ryan's character. And I rewatched The Mexican, which is like Brad Pitt and Julia Roberts. And, you know, at the time it was like Brad and Julia together at last. And the trouble is they are not together at all for basically the whole movie.
Yeah, yeah.
They have like a scene at the beginning and two scenes at the end.
Yeah.
And it's fundamentally unsatisfying. And then to find that, you know, our guys have such chemistry. Yeah, I mean, I'm crowbarring every possible scene with the two of them in together that I can.
What other pairings then were you, did you kind of, that were important for you in terms of kind of watching back to kind of, because it does feel like it's a new genre in a way because it's kind of action romance. You
it's
know?
Definitely a rom-com with big stunts in it.
Yeah, totally. But you love that thing of like Romance in the Stone's one that's kind of come up as well. But things like, I mean, to be honest, most of the films that involve like Harrison Ford with a female co-star that has got elements of comedy in it, I think is kind of a benchmark, really. It's got that kind of same feeling, I feel, as in
100%. I mean, I'll take it all the way back to Billy Wilder. Like, It Happened One Night, and the ability to just kind of go pop, pop, pop with the dialogue.
Yeah.
Two people who feel like they are equals to each other. Or, in fact, you know, as is the case with a lot of Billy Wilder, the female character is a little bit smarter than the male character, and that's what kind of creates some of the romantic tension.
Yeah.
So definitely, like, that was a huge starting point. And then, you know, honestly, I feel like every era has its great, like, leading man, leading woman. I like McConaughey's rom-com era. I think, you know, he's up there with the Harrisons. He makes it seem so natural and real. Like, Sweet Home Alabama.
Oh my God.
I'm a Sweet Home Alabama stan.
I haven't seen that in ages.
Yeah.
Arden's definitely, I think, embraced a bit of the McConaughey in his performance of Tom in this. There's a bit of...
And I was excited by that because I wasn't expecting that to come out. And I think it's actually, it's a really good texture to have in the film.
It's really good. Did you write with music? Did you have musical when you were writing?
I always write with music.
Okay.
I have a playlist that I create for each one of my films, none of which ends up usually in the film. But partly it's a process of... I'm sometimes having to bounce between projects, and it works as a kind of sense memory to kind of like jump back in. There's always one lead track that I'll play, which kind of like clicks me in. On this one, it was Cigarettes After Sex cover of Keep On Loving You, which is just like super, super like moody and romantic.
You should have seen the something missing. You should have known by the tone of my voice, but you didn't listen. You played dead, but you never bled. Instead you lie still.
A mixture of tunes and score, but the challenge as I go through my career, we can put it in inverted commas, is that each, like, I can't repeat tracks playlist to playlist because otherwise it reminds me
of one of the other things
that I've written, of an old love, exactly, of past partners. So Fall Guy had, you know, very much its own soundtrack.
And how do you come to making those choices? Like, how did you come to, you know, in terms of when you're putting those songs on that playlist, what's forming those decisions about what goes on that playlist?
Okay, there are two very weird things that I do to kind of set the template for myself going into a new script. One of them is like, I will spend far too long finding a font for the title on the front cover. No one gives a shit except me. And usually, because of the intricacies of Final Draft, which is the screenwriting program, everyone else just reads it as the normal font anyway. and really can't be bothered to install whatever obscure font that I've found to do the title in. So that's the first, arguably, nerd.
This is just procrastinating, Drew.
You see, I know that's what it sounds like as I'm saying it out loud. But I like to think about it as like getting into the role.
Yeah, it's part of the creative process.
Yeah, exactly. And then the second thing I do is I make the playlist. And I'll usually take half a day, only half a day. I'm a busy man. But I'll take half a day to just kind of like go through my library and kind of work out what scores might go in there, look at movies that are adjacent to it, put some of that in. And then over the course of the first week's writing, I will notice what songs annoy me and I will like quietly remove them from the playlist because they're totally inappropriate.
You should release them.
Yeah, I mean, I think there might be some clearance issues, but...
just for people to listen to on Spotify.
Maybe, yeah.
David said that if people like it, you know, there is the potential for there to be more of these. Sort
a
of
musical,
thing.
A musical. I'm just, I would love there to be a musical version.
I mean,
I'm kind of campaigning for it at this point.
Should that not be film three? I mean, can we have
Do you know what technically the trouble is? If you do a film two, it's very hard to come back from a musical version and just go back to a normal dialogue-based one. So, yeah, roll the dice, leave the musical for film three.
Yeah, but I mean, you've got to be thinking about two.
I mean, one can't help but do it whilst also not wanting to anger the movie gods who will punish you for your hubris of even thinking you can get past the first movie.
But seeing those two in particular, and also Winston, actually.
Yeah.
That kind of those three, there's the kind of flow that those characters have with each other in this film. It does just leave you as a film fan wanting more.
Well, and I think, you know, the dirty secret about a lot of films is as much as they're about dynamics and story and character development, and I think this applies to everything from The Fall Guy to Poor Things, is you want to spend time with the characters.
Yeah.
It's kind of a hang,
yeah.
You know? And it has to be. Like,
yeah.
You're giving up two and a half hours... 3 hours at a push of your life, you know, to be with whoever's on screen. Doesn't mean they have to be nice, but it does mean they have to be magnetic, you know? And I think it's a challenge to create those characters, and that actors in particular did. And so, yeah, you can't help but want the chance to hang with them again.
And then last thing that I wanted to ask is that, because I feel like the film as well reminds people about and celebrates almost like old school stunts.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stunts that are in the film are like, again, nods to specific scenes in old previous films and
100%.
Stuff. Is that...
Yeah, I mean, there? That's kind of how the stunt side of things, David and I approached it from the beginning. I went away and researched the biggest stunts and we did a list of our favourite stunts.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of looked at them and worked out how we could do our own takes. So, you know, where we have Ryan fighting in a skip, that actually evolved from the stagecoach drag originally, which moved on to the Raiders of the Lost Ark drag, and that was how we got to that point. Obviously, we've talked about it a lot, but like I was very competitive from the jump. I literally, in the first draft of the script, when it came to the cannon roll of the car at the beginning, I literally bolded. The characters didn't refer to the fact that we were going to try and beat the Bond stunt in the original draft. I just referred to it in a stage direction. And I was like, Casino Royale has the most roles. It's 7. We're going to beat it. And that was like just literally as a stage direction.
And you did.
And David did. Yeah. David and Chris, like the stunt designer, managed to do it. That car looks mullered at the end, though,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Absolutely.
It doesn't drive off.
No, that's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Listen, we run out of time, but I could chat to you for hours about this. It's such an enjoyable experience to watch this film. I can't wait to pay for a ticket and go and see it again.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. From on the, you know, all of
financial
cinema,
point
all of
view.
Cinema. Thanks you.
From The Fall Guy, that's Pyro Prep by Dominic Lewis, rounding off this special episode of Soundtracking with Drew Pearce, David Leitch and Kelly McCormick. My huge thanks to all three for taking the time to talk to me. Also, thanks to everybody behind the scenes for helping organise those brilliant chats. The Fall Guy is on general release now. It's proper great fun and well worth going to the cinema to see it. If you want to hear my previous chats with David, Kelly and Drew, head to edithbowman.com. Also, we would really appreciate if you could leave us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on socials, we're at Soundtracking UK, and we'd be very grateful if you subscribe to our YouTube channel too, Soundtracking Extra, where we'll be putting up those interviews so you can watch them. Next up, I mentioned this at the start of the show, it's another one of our live shows though, in association with Everyman. Rose Glass joins me to discuss Love Lies Bleeding, which is also out in cinemas as of now. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.